From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The list of top performers who passed away in the last few weeks is heartbreaking. Natalie Cole, David Bowie, Motorhead frontman Lemmy Kilmister, Mott the Hoople drummer Dale Griffin, and Tower of Power co-founder Mick Gillette have all left us in just the past 3 weeks. This week, we added to that devastating roster Glenn Frey, the Detroit singer, songwriter, and guitarist who, along with Don Henley, 4 decades ago formed the Eagles, one of the most successful bands of all time. I had the honor of talking to Frey back in 2012 on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the creation of the Eagles and to mark his first solo album in nearly 20 years. You'll hear that entire conversation this hour.
So 20 years ago, I was a kid out of college working for the mayor of this city, Tom Bradley. And there was this woman who you may recall named Helena. Helena was the queen of these little underground clubs here in L.A. So all these celebrities who want to get out of the house but don't want to. This is before the paparazzi went completely crazy. But they want to get out of the house, but they'd go to these little underground spots. And Helena was the queen of these little places, and you would just know the right person to get in. So I had no business being there. I'm a kid working for the mayor. But Helena needed some work done with the city, had some city ordinance issues. And so I'm working for the mayor, and all of a sudden I get this invitation to go to this club. So I walk in this club a couple times, and the second time I'm there, Glenn Frey walks in the door. There's Jack Nicholson over here, and Janet Jackson's over here, and Glenn Frey walks in the door. And I was a huge Glenn Frey fan. So I walk up, I'm sure this annoying, in-your-face, snotty-nosed kid.
Oh, no.
Because I was so crazy about Glenn Frey. And you sat with me, all my friends know the story, you sat with me for an hour and a half and answered every one of my questions, made me feel like the most important person in the world. I've not seen you in person in 20 years, but that was me then, and here we are now.
That's so great.
Thank you for being so kind to me when you didn't even know who the heck I was.
Well, listen, I knew you were going places. You know.
That is so funny.
Yeah, well, Helena, yeah, she was a friend of Jack Nicholson's.
Right.
I think she was in Five Easy Pieces. Mm-hmm. And she was the girl that sat in the back of the car and hated everything and just looked around and said, crap, that's crap.
Yeah.
I remember that. But she was, like you said, she was sort of the queen of the underground club. And she moved this club a couple times around, and you sort of had to know it was there.
That's right.
And then, you know, we would go down there, like you say, because, you know, no one knew you were coming. And once you got in, you were pretty insulated.
Right.
Food was good.
Yeah.
Pretty girls.
Yeah.
It was a happening place.
You were very nice to me that night, and I've never forgotten that, so thank you for being so kind to me. So it's been a while. I'm glad you did it, but why this project, why this one, and why now?
Well, now because my parents are still alive.
Right.
And I wanted to sort of do this record and, you know, as an homage to the music that they grew up listening to and also the music that I grew up listening to when they were young parents and I grew up in Detroit. So my mother always loved big band music. I have 2 N's in my name because she loved Glenn Miller.
Mm-hmm.
She loved Ella Fitzgerald and Dinah Washington.
Your mom had good taste.
Yeah, my mom had very good taste. So, you know, it was an opportunity for me to, you know, I wanted to get this record done while my parents were still around.
Wow. Which leads to the obvious question. There's some good stuff on here. How did you pick this stuff, this material?
Well, you know, I wanted to sing songs that my voice was comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we sort of started out with just piano and voice, me and my two partners, Richard Davis and Michael Thompson, and I'd throw out an idea for a song, and, you know, we'd say, well, okay, let's pick a key, let's get a lyric sheet, let's, you know, noodle around with it. But mostly, I wanted to do love songs. I wanted this album to have a mood, you know, that ran through the whole record. And, like I said, mostly just stuff that I felt I was comfortable singing.
Mm-hmm. How do you know, it's a silly question, and it may not be an easy answer, answer to the question, but how do you know what's right for your voice? You said a moment ago you want to do stuff that was right for your voice. What's that mean?
Well, I think you have to sort of have a sense of where your range is. I mean, I wouldn't be... one song I wanted to do that I didn't do, Rainy Night in Georgia.
Right.
Brooke Benton, the Tony Joe White song.
Lord,
but I didn't, the baritone, you know, where the song was, you know, it just didn't fit me.
Right.
But I seem to be right kind of in the Tony Bennett, Nat Cole range.
Uh-huh.
You know, that seems to be where my voice sits, so... You know, nothing too hard, nothing too loud.
I'm just curious. So what have your parents have to say about this?
It's their favorite record I've ever made. You know, They like everything I do, but, you know, for them to be able to hear, you know, my interpretation of Dinah Washington, I'm getting old before my time, you know, stuff like that, it really takes them back.
Yeah. I suspect this is probably true for most of us, and no matter how old we get, I think this is probably, again, still the case. But how important is it to do something for your parents that your parents like? I think we all still want, no matter how old we get, that parental approval.
That's right. I don't think that ever goes away.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, here I am, you know, 40 years in the entertainment business going, Mom, do you like this? What do you think? You know, but I think it does mean a lot. And, you know, this is music. It's interesting. When I was growing up in Detroit, you know, the TV was on, the radio was on. My parents watched my hit parade and all the variety shows and stuff. But I never really latched on to the music.
Right.
It was playing and it was around. But then when I came out here to California and I became a songwriter and I met Hoagy Carmichael and I met, you know, I met some other people, you know, then it was like, wow, these songs are good. Yeah. These songs are really good and not that easy to figure out. A lot of subtle and nuanced chord changes. And, you know, it was beautiful music, too. You know, these songs, Shadow of Your Smile, you know, Sentimental Reasons, they take you to a place, you know, a place inside everybody. You know, I was just talking with your producer and he said, well, you know, I got your album and, you know, I knew I was going to produce this segment. So I went on a car trip with my wife and we put it on. And I said, how'd it go? He said, it was great. You know, but this is the kind of record I think that you would want to play if you're taking a drive or having a little dinner party or after hours, everybody's gone to bed and you finally kick your feet up and say, you know, I think I'll have a glass of wine and just take off, take a little vacation.
So. See, it worked for my producer, Chris, because he's already married. I guess the question is, will this get you married?
Well, you know, it couldn't hurt. She'll know you're romantic.
You grew up in Detroit, as you said. I grew up just down the road in Indiana, so we always are proud to claim Hoagy Carmichael out of Indiana. So
you bet.
I love Hoagy Carmichael stuff. But it is fascinating, though, to hear, just ironic, to hear somebody who grew up in Detroit where the music in that city didn't really influence him. It wasn't until you got to California, as you said, when the music thing really hit you. That's a strange thing to say, though. Growing up in Detroit and not, because everybody in Detroit was.
Well, I was real keen on Motown.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, in Detroit, we got not just the big hits, we even got the secondary stuff.
The B-sides.
We heard everything. And, you know, and then there was the British invasion.
Right.
And, you know, I saw the Beatles at the Olympia in Detroit in 1964. And, you know, that was kind of an epiphany for me.
Sure.
You know, wanted to do that and always wanted to come west, you know, the Beach Boys, the Buffalo Springfield, the Birds, the whole San Francisco thing was going on. It was the late 60s. I remember, you know, we'd be watching the Detroit Lions playing an away football game at Kezar Stadium or at the L.A. Coliseum, you know, it'd be December, and they go, we're at Kezar Stadium, 71 degrees and sunshine, you know, and
I got to get to California.
How many more winters till I can go?
You know, we think of Detroit, though. We think of Detroit and Michigan. It's not just Motown. Clearly, Motown's the biggest thing to come out of there. But there's Bob Seger. There's a rock and roll sound that comes out of that area, as well.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bob Seger is my mentor and one of my close friends, one of my heroes. When I was growing up in Detroit, he was like the first guy that had a record deal. He had Cameo Parkway. He was like the first guy that had a local hit, heavy music, and East Side Story. And then I was managed by his manager. My little band, The Mushrooms, was managed by his manager, Punch Andrews.
Glenn, hold up.
Okay.
The Mushrooms?
We had some bad – I had some – that was one of the better names.
One of the better names.
But, you know, it's all the psychedelic
I get it.
But, you know, Bob Seger took a liking to me when he saw my band.
Uh-huh.
And he kind of took me under his wing, and he took me in the recording studio with him. He let me sing and play guitar on Ramblin' Gamblin' Man. He showed me how to make records. He introduced me to Mickey Stevenson, who was a producer over at Motown. He was doing Kim Weston, Marvin Gaye, It Takes Two, stuff like that. You know, and Bob was the first songwriter that I ever met, the guy that wrote his own songs. And we were at a club one night watching another local Detroit band, actually a very good band called The Rationals, and Bob says, you know, they're never going to make it like this. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, they don't write their own songs. He said, Glenn, if you want to write song, you know, if you want to be successful in the music business, you got to write your own songs. So I looked at him kind of the way you're looking at me.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what if they're bad?
Yeah.
And he says, they're going to be.
Yeah.
He says, you're going to write some bad songs, but just keep writing, and eventually you'll write a good one.
Yeah. How did you know? Let me just back up because I missed something here. When, where, and how did you know, figure out that you had this gift of music, that you had this gift of songwriting? I mean, how did that, when did that epiphany happen for you?
Well, I got in a pretty good band in Birmingham, Michigan, called The Four of Us. It was probably the only surf band in Detroit.
Right.
Everybody wanted to be Mitch Ryder in the Detroit Wheels or the Rolling Stones.
Right.
Every band had a lead singer, and then the guys around him playing their instruments to whatever level of proficiency
right. You
know, they could. But I got in this band with a couple guys from Birmingham, and they were doing Beach Boys songs and Beatles songs and Buckinghams and songs with background vocals. Mm-hmm. So I really kind of got into the group singing thing and the melodic thing, and I enjoyed it so much. And, you know, and like I said, I got a lot of encouragement from Bob. You know, he said, you're good, you know, and, you know, you're going to get better, but you got to write your own songs.
Yeah.
So then I came out to California. Now, my girlfriend was from Detroit, and she was in a little singing group called the Mama Cats, four white girls.
Oh, come
from,
on, come
listen
on,
listen to
man.
This. Four white
they were
four,
the Mama Cats.
They're four white girls from Grosse Pointe, Southfield, downtown
right.
Detroit, that
uh-huh.
sang Supremes, Martha and the Vandellas. They sang Motown songs.
Mm-hmm.
They came out to California, got signed by Lee Hazelwood. And when the first day I came out to California, I met a guy named J.D. Souther. He was going out with my girlfriend's sister.
Mm.
So I started hanging out with him. He was into country music. He was into a lot of music that I wasn't familiar with, jazz, R&B. And, you know, we said we had a lot of time to burn, so we listened to a lot of records the first couple of years I was out here.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, my biggest break was getting hired to play rhythm guitar with Linda Ronstadt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Don Henley got hired from his band to play drums with Linda Ronstadt, and that's where he and I met. And that's where we met Linda, and then, you know, things got rolling from there.
The rest, as they say, is history.
Mm-hmm.
When you look back on the genesis of that relationship with Don Henley, what comes to mind?
Well, when I first met him, a couple
right.
things, you know. When I first met him, you know, I loved his voice. I loved his singing voice. I saw his band play at the Troubadour, and then when we went out with Linda, Don and I were the principal singers with Linda.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, you know, I loved playing with him, and I loved singing with him and doing those songs. What I didn't know was that he was just a couple credits away from his degree in English literature at North Texas State.
Mm-hmm.
So we made the first Eagles record, and Don and I hadn't written any songs on it. But when we came back from London, we were a little bit worried about the overall, you know, content of the record. We had a few good songs, but not a lot.
Right.
And we were managed by David Geffen and Elliot Roberts at the time, and they had Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Jackson Browne. So Don and I kind of looked at each other and go, you know, we better write some good songs, and we better write them pretty quick, or we're not going to be around.
Right.
They're not going to want us around with these other people who are so talented. And so Don Henley and I decided that we would try to write songs together. And this is when I discovered what a poet he was.
Mm-hmm.
So the first week we tried to write, we wrote Desperado and Tequila Sunrise.
The first week.
So
you guys did Desperado the first week?
You know, there was something clicked.
Gee,
something,
I'll say.
Something clicked. And, you know, we've been able to write songs ever since. And I felt comfortable with him, you know.
Mm.
He's very bright. He's very, what's the word I'm looking for? He wants to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
We will work on two or three lines for a month or two until if the words, just to try to get more meaning, to try to get the lines right. He's very tenacious.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we're able, for some reason, you know, you have to be comfortable with somebody you're writing songs with.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it was a good thing. You know, if you're writing songs by yourself, well, who's going to tell you if it's good or not?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're writing songs with somebody else, you know, you get that immediate feedback. And I immediately started to trust him. And I think he trusted me, too. So I never had a problem when he said, I don't like that. Or, you know what I mean? I was never offended
right.
for some reason. I felt like, okay, you know, yeah, you're probably right. It's probably, you know, maybe we should work on that a little more. Or that's good.
Yeah.
That's really good. Let's use that. Write that down.
You mentioned his love of literature. So just take me inside the writing room, metaphorically speaking. How does the collaborative process actually work for the two of you?
Well, in our heyday,
right.
You know, I would say, you know, we would basically come into a room, sit mm-hmm. down at my house or up at his house. Sometimes we lived together. Mm-hmm. And I go over to the piano and say, you know, hey, what do you think of this? Mm-hmm. You know, and I play something. And he'd go, yeah, I like that. Maybe get up and start singing. That's the way we wrote One of These Nights. Mm. I just went over to the piano and I started playing this little minor descending progression. And he comes over and goes, one of these nights. You know, so in the best of times, you know, it just kind of flows. We would just get together every day and work, and you have great days, and some days are not so great. But, you know, I think the level of trust is really the key.
Yeah. Obviously, the relationship between you and Henley kicks up when you guys are both, as you said, hanging out and playing with Linda Ronstadt. But what did you learn from her, being with her? And I ask that because as I think about this new project of yours, After Hours, one of my favorite Linda Ronstadt projects was when she did the thing with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. Is that an amazing record? That Nelson Riddle piece was absolutely phenomenal. But what did you take away from being with her all that time?
Follow your musical instincts.
Right.
Do what you feel is right. You know, don't be relegated to a certain category. You know, Linda Ronstadt, she had a whole string of hit records with the Heart Like a Wheel album, you know, You're No Good, mm-hmm. and, you know, the Everly Brothers song, and, you know, Neil Young songs. She had all these pop records. And all of a sudden now, I wasn't playing with her anymore, and the Eagles are off doing their thing, and I hear, where's Linda? Oh, she's in New York doing Pirates of Penzance with Kevin Kline.
Mm-hmm.
She's singing, you know, and I'm going, wow.
And now doing mariachi stuff.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then she did the records with Nelson Riddle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my humble opinion, those are the best records. Those records are nearly perfect.
I think you're
right. I also loved Harry Nilsson, Touch of Schmielsen in the Night, Willie Nelson, Stardust. But Linda's records, I thought, were the Nelson Riddle arrangements were mm-hmm. perfect. Her voice is like chocolate; it's sweet, it's rich. You know, it's those were great records, and you know, I'm excited. I hope she gets this record. I might have to send her a copy or two and say, see what you started. I always wanted to do this after I heard you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I feel better knowing that Glenn Frey and I agree on Linda Ronstadt and Nelson Riddle. That was good stuff. What do you then make of, whether you guys are together on tour or not, the enduring, abiding love for the Eagles catalog?
Well, I think that's what it is, you know. Yeah. People connect, you know, the songs connect with people. And somebody once said something real interesting to me. They said, you know, people didn't just listen to the Eagles, they did things to the Eagles.
Mm-hmm.
They broke up with their girlfriend. They got in a car with a bunch of guys and drove from Chicago to California. They mm-hmm. asked somebody out that they never had the nerve to. You know uh-huh. what I'm saying? You know, I think it was there was a big connection.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were just trying to be as good as the people we admired. You know, our goals were not any bigger than that, really.
Mm-hmm.
But we did a really good job. We learned how to write songs. We learned how to make records. And we had a unique vocal sound. But I really think it's the songs. And that's that's why we're still around.
Yeah. You just said something that I find really fascinating. And it's not rocket science, but I had never thought about it in that way as a benchmark. So what say you to young songwriters about the advice you just offered, which is just try to be as good as the folk that you admire? I mean, that's a pretty good... That's a pretty good benchmark to shoot for.
Yeah, I think you do have to have your influences, and you know, and I think it, you know, if you were to, for example, as a songwriter, if I said to you, okay, I want you to get the Beatles songbook, and I want you to get Motown songbook, I want you to learn all those songs, and if you do that, you will have spent some time with some of the greatest material,
right.
And some of it's going to rub off on you. Sometimes I've been talking recently in New York City at NYU and here at USC
mm-hmm.
With some of the young songwriters in the music programs there. And the other thing I tell them is, and I don't mean this in an unkind way, but I say, people don't care how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
You need to paint pictures. You need to tell stories. That's what people want. They want to be entertained. And then all of the other stuff kind of filters across as part of the whole thing. But really, you know, people want to be entertained.
It's like a master class with Glenn Frey.
No,
I love this. Paint, but that's great advice, though. Paint pictures and tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
That is true, though. And if you can put a little melody in there.
Well, I mean, you know, take Hotel California
right.
as a song as an example.
Mm-hmm.
I really think one of the greatest allies you can have is the imagination of your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And because we were visual songwriters. There were no videos. We didn't have, you know, any of that.
Right.
You know, so we tended to become, you know, to be visual songwriters. We wanted people to see things while they were listening to our records. But, I mean, Hotel California, it's just sort of one-shots of, you know, we talked about when we were writing the song, so it's like the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
I said, it doesn't really matter. Just show these pictures. Guy's in a car. Guy lights up a cigarette. Guy gets to the hill. Guy sees the lights. He pulls over. He opens the door. He's in a weird hotel with strange people. It doesn't matter. Everybody can imagine, you know, and everybody imagines, everybody always asks, what is Hotel California about? And I always say, what do you think it's about?
Right.
Because I think that's, you know, that's a powerful thing, to be able to engage your audience and let them put some of themselves into the music.
What spurs that? What stirs that?
Well, you know, it's, in music, it can be a number of things, you know. Sometimes it's just the mood. So I think that it's just a sort of matter of finding out what's interesting, you know, what makes people want to listen, paint a little picture, and create a mood with the chords and the instruments.
Kind of like the heat is on.
Well, now the heat is on. Now that's another.
That pulls you in, man.
That's a funny, you know.
Go ahead and tell me. I want
okay,
to hear
here's
this.
The heat is on
All
story.
Right.
Okay, the Eagles are broke up,
right?
And it's in the middle 80s. And Irving Azoff, my manager, calls me up and said, Glenn, you got to come to a screening. We're going to show this movie, this Eddie Murphy movie. It's going to be huge. You got to get a song in it. Come on. So, you know, I went to the screening, and I'm sitting there, and Don was there, and Irving was there. And we're waiting for the movie to start, and I look over my shoulder, Quincy Jones. Okay, and I look over my shoulder, Stevie Wonder. You know, look back over here, it's the Pointer Sisters. You know, I'm sitting there going, I'm dead. There's no way I'm getting a song in Beverly Hills Cop. So we watched the movie with temp music, and it was fabulous, and we laughed, and everybody said, this movie is going to be huge. But I never thought I'd get a song in it. So a month or two go by, and then all of a sudden somebody says, hey, we're going to send you a song. See if you maybe want to sing it. It's written by these guys, Keith Forsey and Harold Faltermeyer, the guys in Munich that do the Donna Summer records. I'm going to send you something, see if you want to sing it. So they sent me a demo of The Heat Is On. And it sounded, you know, kind of like a Huey Lewis thing, you know, with the saxophone in it. Kind of sounded like something I might do. So I said, okay, you know, I'll do it. So I met the guys. I came in. I sang it one day. I played guitar and did background vocals the next day. And I got a small check, I think 15 grand. And I had a little Christmas money, and I was happy. Like I said, I never thought I'd get a song in Beverly Hills Cop. And 2.5 months after I saw the screening, they sent me this tape. Mm-hmm. And it sounded, you know, kind of like Huey Lewis, kind of like something I might do. I said, what the heck, it's Christmas, you know, they'll pay me a little money. You know, so I went, I sang it one day, and I played guitar and sang background vocals the next day, and I didn't really think too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the movie came out and the record came out, and then not only that, but I mean, you know, they're playing The Heat Is On for the Big East basketball tournament.
Mm-hmm.
It's all playing all over all these sporting events. You know, the record sells, you know, millions and millions of copies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had all those great records on it, Neutron Dance and, and Axel's Theme. And I was very lucky. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Well, you can't imagine that movie, though, without that song. And those opening scenes of that car, that semi chase.
Oh, yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, with him hanging out the semi like that, yeah.
All the cigarettes, yeah, in the back of the truck. But the movie is not the same without that song. How much of, since you went there, how much of your career, or are there moments in your career beyond that where it really was about, I mean, your gift is undeniable. But how much of your success has to do with timing, as you said, with being in the right place at the right. Are there other examples of that where things just happen for you because?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it happens, you know, often.
Right.
You know, but I think it's, you know, it's, you also got to be there,
mm-hmm.
and you also got to be ready,
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, when the light shines, you know, you're able to step up and, you know, and do what you got to do. You know, if it wasn't for, if I hadn't met Jackson Browne,
mm-hmm.
I'd have never met David Geffen.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'd have never met David Geffen, you know, I would have never had a place to bring the Eagles. And, you know, it was interesting when I told you before, Bob Seger gave me a great bit of advice, which was you got to write your own songs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jackson Browne was very kind to J.D. Souther and I and a lot of the guys that were working the folk club circuit back in 1970, 71. And he introduced J.D. and I to David Geffen. I went on the road with Linda Ronstadt, and we had 3 days off. And he said, what do you want to do? You want to go to Nashville or you want to go to Muscle Shoals? And we all looked at each other and said, let's go to Muscle Shoals. So I called David Geffen up and I said, can I have $500 to do a demo? I want to do some of the songs that I'm going to be doing. So we went in there and I spent $2,300. I was in there for 2 days. And I brought the, you know, I brought the stuff back to David Geffen. He wasn't, not only was he mad that I spent extra money, but he wasn't too impressed.
Right.
He said to me, Glenn, you should be in a band. He said, you're not a solo artist. He said, you should get in a band. You can play to your strengths. You can hide your weaknesses. You can be around some guys that are good. And, you know, I think that's the way you should go. And then I said, okay. Mm-hmm. And so then I set out to put together a band. And I knew I wanted to be with Don Henley, you know, and have, you know, I want to have great singers as well as good players. And then we told Linda Ronstadt that we wanted to have our own band. She was thinking about putting together a super group to back her up
mm-hmm.
with all the best country rock musicians. And we said to Linda, well, you know, we want to have our own band. Now, I guess she could have been miffed, but she wasn't. She said, I understand. I understand that. And you know who would be really good with you is Bernie Ledden. And when we play Disneyland, I'm going to get Bernie to come out and jam with us. So she brought Bernie in, and
wow.
Don and I met her. And then we had another gig up in Los Altos at a restaurant performance place. And we got she helped us get Randy Meisner to come and replace the bass player for a weekend so we could meet him. So Linda really helped us, you know, get the Eagles together. But that's all kind of, you know, that's a little serendipitous. The stars got to line up, you know.
You said a couple things I want to go back and get and have you just kind of unpack for me. One, I think you're right about the fact, and this my phraseology of what you just said, you got to be open to constructive criticism. You got to be open to critique. But not everybody is, particularly if you are, you know, hell-bent on the idea that this is what I'm going to do and this is how I'm going to do it. So when David Geffen, I mean, obviously you have to respect his artistic genius and his style. But what was it about David Geffen? Obviously, your trust or something in him that allowed you to accept so easily his critique of you, or are you just putting on and you really didn't accept it that easily?
No. You know, I mean, he was the golden boy.
Right.
He was representing not only Laura Nero, you know, Joni Mitchell, like I said, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Neil Jackson. You know, I mean, he was the songwriter's agent
mm-hmm.
and manager. So he was right.
Mm-hmm.
He was right. At 22, 23 years old, I wasn't ready to make a solo album. I wasn't even ready to write songs, really. You know, I was just getting going in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So he was right. Mm-hmm. And then I went out and we got Bernie to come and jam, and mm-hmm. I pitched him about what we were going to do, and got Randy to come and jam at another show, and I pitched him about what we were going to do. And then I went back and I called up David Geffen. I said, David, we got to have a meeting. I just told Bernie Ledden and Randy Meisner, I know you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not sure if they believe me, but I think we need, you know, can we get together?
Right.
So we walked in to David's office, and Bernie Ledden, who's, you know, kind of, what's the word I want to look for? He's a little surly, you know, in a kind of a good way. But no, we came into David's office, and he sat down, and Bernie kind of went, well, do you want us or not?
Yeah.
You know? And I think, as I recall, David was a little like, you know, didn't really know what to say for a minute or
right.
two. And they said, well, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and here's what I want to do, you
yeah.
know? And then we started talking about producers and what to do. Mm-hmm. They were real smart. The first thing they did when we got together was they sent us to Colorado to play in a ski bar for 4 weeks
uh-huh.
and get our act together. And work out and get to know each other, and so that was a big step. And then we came back to LA and played,
right.
and then got Glyn Johns, the British producer, to produce us. I was just over in London. It's so strange, you know, to imagine that Take It Easy and Desperado
yeah.
and all of these songs were recorded in London when they're sort of California
yeah.
country rock.
So the other thing I want to go back to, so. Geffen gives you his critique and says, by being in a band, you can play to your strengths, and you can hide or mask your weaknesses. Great advice, but you have to know what your strengths and weaknesses are. What were they? And I assume by now you probably moved past that. But what were you good at then? And what were your weaknesses at that point, when you and the Eagles first got together? What did the band allow you to mask?
Well, I wasn't the best guitar player in the band, so we needed a better guitar player.
Okay.
I couldn't be the only guy.
That's an honest answer. I mean, most people wouldn't want to go anywhere near a question,
you know,
like this.
And, you know, and it was really sort of the songwriting thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't really even know how to write a song. I was living in Echo Park mm-hmm. in a really small $60 a month place. J.D. Souther and I both had it. And underneath in an apartment that was probably illegal, it was so small, lives Jackson Browne.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go out to the Troubadour every night and drink beers and come home late, try to meet girls. And 9 o'clock in the morning, I hear the tea kettle going off in Jackson's apartment underneath me.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd go over, you'd hear him playing the piano. He'd be working on Rock Me on the Water, or he'd be working on, you know, these songs like this, and he'd work on a verse and he'd play it 6 or 7 times and I'd roll over in bed, I guess, you know, and then there'd be silence. And then, you know, I'd fall back to sleep. And then I'd hear the teapot go off again, and then he'd come back to the piano and he'd have the second verse.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd play the first verse, the chorus, and the second verse over and over and over again until he was really happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm laying up there going, so that's how you do it. It's elbow grease, it's persistence, it's repetition, it's revision. You don't just sit down and, you know, light up and then, you know, mm-hmm. the muse smiles on you and you write some great song. So that I took that to heart. He wasn't even trying to show me how to write songs, but he really was showing me how to write songs. It was a lot of work. Hoagie Carmichael once said, they asked him about, you know, writing songs, and he said, well, first of all, you better really want to.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's not easy, it's a challenge, but it's one I welcome. That's why I still write songs, because I never know how it's going to turn out.
Why, though, to Hoagie's admonition, why, though, have you and do you still want to?
Well, it's what I'm good at.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm good at writing songs and I'm good at making records. And, you know, and so I enjoy doing it. And I enjoy the self-exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember when the Eagles got back together in 1994, and I hadn't really seen, you know, I'd seen Don off and on, always pleasant, always sending each other our best wishes. But we hadn't written a song together in 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember when we wrote Get Over It, we looked at each other and said, we can still do it, man. We still got it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so that started us again on another cycle of writing songs. But I think the songwriting thing is the key piece.
That was the When Hell Freezes Over tour.
That's right. That's right, because they used to ask,
aptly named,
when are the Eagles getting back together? And that's what we would all say.
Yeah.
So I thought it was. thought it was pretty good. That was pretty good funny. Way to start.
Yeah, aptly titled. When we were talking about The Heat Is On, you referenced going to a screening and you looked over one shoulder and you saw Quincy Jones, over another shoulder you saw Stevie Wonder and a few other great songwriters. What kind of songwriters, you mentioned Hoagy Carmichael a couple times in this conversation, who would intimidate you as a songwriter? And I don't mean intimidate in terms of frightening you to the point of, you know, scaring the gift out of you, but people who you just look at and say, that is a songwriter.
Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
Bacharach and David.
Mm-hmm.
Holland, Dozier and Holland.
Wow.
Smokey Robinson. Marvin Gaye. Paul Simon. James Taylor.
Yeah.
Just for starters.
Yeah.
Don Henley. Don Henley.
Just for starters, yeah. Yeah. Have you figured out yet? I always ask this question, as the audience knows. I always ask this question because I'm curious of every great songwriter. What their definition is of a good song or a great song. What makes a great song for you after all these years?
Nothing's out of place,
mm-hmm.
first of all. It seems like everything that happens in the song is natural.
Mm-hmm.
And you never go, oh, why did he go to that chord? Or why did they put a bridge there? It didn't need, you know. So it always has a natural flow to
mm-hmm.
it. And then it's a sort of a combination after that of the chord changes, the melody, and the lyrics, and how it all flows together.
Mm-hmm.
But and then, you know, the other thing is it's visceral. It gets you. Gets you in some sort of place that's mind, spirit, body, cosmic place.
Mm.
That's something that happens when we listen to music. And, you know, I mean, like these songs on After Hours, just mm-hmm. to get back to that for a minute, you know, I've been playing some shows with the orchestra, and people are in the audience. And, of course, I open up with a few Eagles songs. Everybody relaxes and, mm-hmm. no, I'm not going to just indulge myself in whatever I want. And then I start playing songs from this record. And I'll start out and play Sentimental Reasons. And I'll look out at the audience. I'll see some guy leaning up going, I like that song. Do you like that song? Yeah, I like that song.
Mm-hmm.
And they're watching like this. And then after that, I'll go into Shadow of Your Smile. And all of a sudden, the hands are touching.
Mm-hmm.
It's going, I like that song, too. You know, and something happens
right.
to people, this romantic music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what music does. It gets us in a place that language alone can't go.
Yeah. I have always, since being a kid, I've always loved strings. Strings do it for me. But do you have to this new project, After Hours, do you have to be, or when you achieve a certain age, can you appreciate this stuff better?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. You know, I don't think these songs are easy to write. You know, I don't think any songs are easy to write. But the orchestra is just another thing. You know, we use synthesizers to do mock-ups for strings,
mm-hmm.
and some stuff we do has got electric guitars. We might just put a pad there. But there is nothing like the real players being in a room with them, watching the bows, you know, having all that happen. It's like you're on a magic carpet ride. You're surrounded in this big, wonderful, warm place. You know, it's hard not to sing well and with feeling, you know, when you're surrounded with all of this orchestrations.
You use an iPod?
No.
You don't?
No.
You don't use one?
I'm kind of technophobic.
Wow.
Write songs, write letters by hand. I text. That's
yeah.
about as far as I've gone.
That's cool, actually. No, nobody. You know, I'm glad you said that. I was in a conversation the other day about the fact that nobody writes letters anymore. Nobody writes letters anymore, and I actually like that. I've been, over the course of my life and career, I guess it started out as a pack rat, but at some point, I really started to appreciate my pack rat nature. Because I have this wonderful collection of anything ever sent to me by anybody who mattered to me that I've kept. I've kept every letter I think my mother ever wrote me.
Mm-hmm.
And from presidents and kings and personalities. I mean, I just have a huge basement. I know this because I had a lady come to my house last year and archive all this stuff for me. But it was so cool to sit in the middle of the floor and to just go through all these handwritten letters that I've received from all kinds of people, many famous, some not so famous. But the richness of being able to put your hands on this as opposed to looking at it on a on an iPhone, nothing against the iPhone, with a text, just it did something for me. So to hear you say that you still write letters, you still write stuff down, is pretty cool.
I just, you know, it feels good. It feels comfortable for me. It's the way I've always done it. I think there's something about looking at the words on paper that's different than looking at the words on the screen. You know, so like I said, it's just, I'm just kind of old-fashioned that way. I remember I was writing an outline for a book. I wanted to write a book about my life in the Eagles. I still do, and I hope to get to it in not-too-distant future. But I remember when I was writing the outline, a friend of mine who was helping me with it said, well, go on computer and do this, and, you know, it's going to be a lot easier, and, you know, started. So I could, you know, I barely got the title page centered, and I was already struggling and stuff. I said, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm going to write on a legal pad, then I'm going to have somebody type it out, triple-spaced, then I'm going to take a look at it, make my changes, and then we're going to print it up again, but that's the way I got to do it. Now, my best friend and road manager, a guy named Tommy Nixon, his father-in-law was Ray Bradbury.
Oh, wow.
And when I was getting all frustrated about how I'd get these computers, I can't really do this, just give me a legal pad. And Tommy goes, Glenn, it's okay. Ray writes on a legal pad.
Mm-hmm.
And an old typewriter that he goes like this. Mm-hmm. He says, so don't worry, you don't have to be, you know, computer proficient to write. So I've kind of, like I said, I haven't really totally embraced that yet.
I'm still writing on legal pads myself. I can't help it. Since you went there, this is the 40th anniversary, 40 years since the Eagles got together. I suspect that there are a lot of stories over that four decades. And I also suspect that now that you've told the world you want to write a book about your life with the Eagles, you're going to get 25 million publishers calling you tomorrow trying to close that deal and offering you a ghostwriter who will type, write however you want it done. But what is it, and I don't want to get too far inside the book, obviously, because you haven't written it as yet, but are there things... Or are there themes that you want us to know about this four decade journey that we think we know and really don't?
I think that there's certainly things that probably need to be explained a little better.
Right.
You know, the Eagles, we weren't very much of a media band. We didn't do a lot of interviews. We didn't expose that way. This year, at Christmas or just after Christmas, we have a 2-DVD history of the Eagles. That's going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been kind of digging through the past, and we hired a great director to do this project for us. His name is Alex Gibney. Mm-hmm. He won the Academy Award for Taxi to the Dark Side.
Absolutely,
smartest guys in the room. Enron. You know, I'd seen a bunch of videos of guys that had done music biography type stuff, and I said, hold it, just send me a reel of the guys that got nominated for Best Director of a documentary. So I looked through this and I chose Alex. And I said, can we have a meeting? So I met with him in New York. And I remember before I met him, I went back to my outline to look at, especially 1971 through 1980. And when I sat down with him, I said, Alex, I said, every year the Eagles had huge obstacles that had to be overcome. We had to change producers, record companies, managers, personnel, business managers. All these changes, every time there was something that really had to overcome it. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, looking back on it, you know, when I was young, I'm just pushing the boulder up the mountain, you know. There was nothing going to, you know, I feel like there was nothing going to stop me. Come on, let's go. We got to fix this. But as I looked back on it, you know, I noticed that, you know, there were really, you know, things that we had to overcome. And then the other thing that I noticed was we really had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Eagles, we're intense. We're serious guys. We're volatile. We all care about what we're doing. You know, we don't always agree, but it's because we're passionate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think, and probably, you know, maybe one of the biggest misnomers is people think that the Eagles argue a lot. We don't. But we don't always agree either. You know, I mean, I feel like the Eagles is a very worthwhile relationship. We've had peaks and valleys, and we've sustained, you know, like a good marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, basically, I think one of the reasons why we've managed to survive this long is because we really care about each other. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the one thing that I think people might not think is that we didn't have as much fun as maybe we really did.
Yeah.
We had a lot of fun.
Yeah. I don't find that hard to believe. Get a band together. There's going to be some fun had somewhere. I'm going to close this conversation where we began. I was thanking you for being so kind to me. Not that it should have mattered that I was a nobody, and for that matter, I still may be a nobody. But you spent time with me at that underground club that Helena opened up and talked to me, like I really mattered, and I've never forgotten that 20 years ago. But you weren't married then, and since then you got married and got a few kids, and that's what happens when you, you know,
stick around.
You stick around, yeah. Life goes on. You're not hanging out in clubs anymore, meeting chicks, yeah. You know. So how has that changed, Glenn Frey, over the years, the wife and the babies?
It's nice to have someone to share your ups and downs with.
Yeah.
You know, it means a lot more, you know, when you can come home and, you know, talk about it. Great wife, you know, great kids. I have a rule, which is never brag about your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just make sure everything's going good. But I'm very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, marriage, children, that's the real world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Eagles is a vacation. The Eagles is, you know, I used to say, I only go on the road with the Eagles because that's where people do what I tell them. You know, it's the only, you know, I just played the Wiltern with the orchestra. It was a crowning night, wonderful performance, Santa Monica High School Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's great. We're at the after party, and all of a sudden it's 1:30, and they're getting ready to close the place. I said, you know, I think I'm going to stay for another half hour because I know what's waiting. Garbage, dishwasher, dog doo, you know. So, you know, but, you know, that's the real world, and that's, you know, that's the biggest challenge and the biggest reward.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I live in the real world. I'm glad you are a part of this real world.
And we were in the real world together, and we didn't know it.
But, yeah.
You know, that makes me feel real good that we had this conversation, that I met you and we had this conversation, because that's the way I am, and that's the way you were, and now here we are, you know, able to enjoy this moment and look back. And
You have infinitely enhanced my life with your gift, your artistry, and I learned that night. Your humanity as well, and it's a blessing to have you on this program. Honored to have you here, man.
Thanks, Tavis.
I've enjoyed this immensely.
Me too.
Thank you, sir.
One day we walked along the sand, one day in early spring, you held a piper in your hand.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.